Hi there, you're listening to Camille Parle Sexe, your sexual wellness podcast. I am Camille Bataillon, clinical sexologist, and in this podcast, I want to give you la crème de la crème in sexology. With my guest or on my own, we will reflect together on sexuality, human relationship, and every aspect of intimacy to give you the best of sex education. I hope to inspire you in your intimacy and put some glitter in your sexuality. Alors, bienvenue! Hello, welcome to a new episode of Camille Parle Sexe, a Frenchie talks about sex. In this episode, we're going to talk about sexual health in women and mindfulness with Dr. Laurie Brotteau. Dr. Laurie Brotteau holds a Canada Research Chair in Women's Sexuality Health. She's Executive Director of the Women's Health Research Institute in Canada, and she's a registered psychologist providing sex therapy to people of all genders. I have to tell you something. I'm a big fan of Dr. Laurie Brotteau's works. In 2018, I did my master's thesis about mindfulness in heterosexual couple practicing orgasmic meditation. And for my research, I had to study a lot about mindfulness. And who I found on my path? Dr. Laurie Brotteau. She's the queen of mindfulness in sexual health and specifically in women's sexual health. In this episode, I ask her many questions and I love the way she answers it. She is very clear and, you know, I hope at the end of the episode you will want to practice more mindfulness in your life. I ask her many questions, as for example, what are some key findings from her research on how mindfulness practice can benefit women in their sex life? I also ask some of your questions, for example, some tips to be more present with ourselves. How can I begin to incorporate mindfulness into my sex life? And how to talk about it with my partner? And is mindfulness for everyone? I hope you will enjoy your conversation. Bonne écoute. Dr. Laurie, I'd like to start this podcast, if you'd like, with an informal question. How is the day as a director of the Women's Health Institute in Canada looks like?
Wow, well, it's a wonderful question. I think there's a lot of diversity in my role. One of the things I absolutely love is working with students and trainees. And so in my capacity as being a professor in obstetrics and gynecology, I supervise many undergraduates, graduate students, postdocs, medical students who are engaged in research. They're all at different points along the trajectory of being involved in research. And so it's a real joy for me to mentor them in their research projects. And then, of course, I have my own research projects that are well underway, and I do clinical work. And I also have an administrative role where I'm the executive director of the Women's Health Research Institute, which is an institute dedicated to advancing the science of women's health.
Wow. It's very diverse. I think you can't get bored. And I can hear you're passionate about your work.
So, yeah.
And we're going to talk about your research because you've done a lot in the research of women's sexuality and especially in the topics of mindfulness. And for the context, for the audience, I discovered your work in 2018 while I was studying in Montreal, Canada. And my coursework on sexual dysfunction led me to discover your work, you know. And I based a lot my master's thesis, which was about mindfulness practice, which is called orgasmic meditation. And I based a lot of my theory on your work because, I mean, you are not only the pioneer, for me, you are the queen of the mindfulness, of the new protocol in treating sexual dysfunction with mindfulness practices. Could you tell us what is mindfulness in sexual health?
Yeah. So let's start with mindfulness, and then we'll talk about mindfulness in sexual health. So mindfulness really refers to present moment, non-judgmental awareness, and it derives from meditation. Meditation, of course, has been around for 3,000 to 4,000 years. But mindfulness is really the secular adaptation of meditation. It doesn't require any particular religious affiliation. And the instructions are really quite simplified. It is about noticing what arises in the present moment and doing so non-judgmentally. So when we take that definition of mindfulness and apply it now to sexuality, it is about mindfully noticing whatever arises, either during sexual activity, during imagined sexual activity, during a feeling of maybe sexual excitement or pleasure, and observing everything that arises just as it is, without judgment and with lots of compassion. And my view is that this is especially important to apply to sexual health, because it is an area where a lot of people are plagued with judgments and worries and catastrophizing and imagining what's going to happen, and not in a good way. So it, in my mind, it really is the ideal place to bring this skill of present moment non-judgmental awareness to.
Present moment with no judgment. And it's true, in one of your studies, you were showing that women generally associate like their sexual responses with negative emotion, which can then be responsible for certain sexual disorders. And we're going to talk more about this as well, because it's important for the people to understand how they can apply mindfulness in their daily life, but mostly here in their intimacy life. And I will have a few questions for you. Okay. But deeper, because you are, as a researcher, like you've conducted a lot of studies on mindfulness and how mindfulness can benefit women. So what are some key findings from your research on how mindfulness practices benefit women experiencing sexual difficulties? What are the thing you really find through your research?
Yeah. And now we can confidently answer that question there, because there have been quite a large number of studies that include comparison groups and that follow participants and women over time. And so, drawing from the findings of one of our randomized clinical trials that was published last year, among women who had distressing low desire, and after they participated in our 8-week mindfulness program, they saw very dramatic improvements in their self-reports of desire. The measure we gave was kind of a composite measure of desire and arousal. So they found themselves to be more responsive during sexual encounters. They found themselves to be more motivated for sex. They found themselves to be more likely to accept a partner's invitation to sexual activity. And this improvement was sustained a year later. So a year after they completed our 8 weeks, we reassessed everyone and asked them, are you still practicing the mindfulness? And then readministered all the same measures. And those improvements in desire were maintained. The other place where we see quite a dramatic improvement is in sexual distress. So sexual distress is, how much do these issues bother you? And often it's distress that leads a person to seek treatment for their sexual concern. So just like desire, we saw very significant improvements in distress that were maintained a year later. So those are kind of the two key things that we're measuring. Of course, we're measuring a whole host of other outcomes like rumination and depression and quality of life and relationship satisfaction. And for the most part, across the board, we saw improvements in all of those secondary domains as well.
Wow. I mean, people who are listening may be like, wow, in 8 weeks, I can see some improvement. Like, first, why 8 weeks? Is, for example, we do it for 1 week or 2 weeks. Is it different?
Yeah. When I started to do this work in 2002, that was a question that I had. And at that time, the mindfulness literature, the kind of general science of mindfulness for anxiety and depression, was really just starting. And so there wasn't a lot of empirical data to guide that question. So I started out with 3 sessions, and it was 1 session per month over 3 months. And we saw improvements. Over time, we decided to go with 8 weeks, in part because the women in the groups told us. So when we did it for 4 weeks, at the end, they said, this should be at least double. Wow. So we doubled it. The other reason to go with 8 weeks is that it makes what we are doing very consistent with other mindfulness-based interventions. So mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, in general, they tend to be 8 weeks.
Yeah, it's what I read in the studies. Is usually the protocol is 8 weeks. And so what did you do during those 8 weeks? What are the participants were doing? What kind of practices?
Yeah, so we had a 2-hour session once a week. So they would come to the session and there was usually two facilitators, so myself and someone else. And the entire first hour of that session, we were guiding them through a mindfulness exercise. And then we would do an inquiry. An inquiry is where you then dive a little bit deeper into what came up for you during that mindfulness exercise. So really, an entire hour was dedicated to mindfulness practice and inquiry. And then after that, the second hour was reviewing the home practices, talking about how did it go, what made it difficult to practice mindfulness on a regular basis, et cetera. And then we gave them homework. So after every session, we sent them home with an audio guide to the meditation that they were going to listen to over the week, as well as some written instructions on some other homework exercises. So we provided some background reading about mindfulness and the science of mindfulness. We also included some psychoeducation as well. So what is the sexual response cycle? How common are sexual difficulties? How do you think about the causes of your sexual difficulties? So that was what we labeled as the more psychoeducational material.
Nice. Like some sex education, resources, guiding them through meditation. I'm wondering as well, those women were in relationship, were there any information regarding the relationship or like some, you know, like inviting the partner as well, doing this as well?
Yeah, so in this last randomized trial that I mentioned to you, about 2/3 were in relationships. It wasn't a requirement that women be in a relationship because most of what we asked them to do, they were doing on their own. But for those who were in relationships, number one, we asked them to share whatever they felt comfortable sharing with a partner. Right? So they could talk about it at home. And then we also included sensate focus exercises. And we introduced that at the very, very end of the 8 weeks. Because again, not everyone was in a relationship, or even those who were in a relationship, not everyone felt safe or comfortable to practice and introduce sensate focus with a partner. So in a separate analysis, we compared the partnered women to the unpartnered women in terms of the main outcomes of desire and distress, and there was no difference.
Ah, interesting. Because I wanted to ask as well for the partner woman who, for example, wanted to do sunset focus with her partner, and let's imagine the partner say, no, it's not my thing. Would you see a difference in terms of like mindfulness and apply in terms of libido?
Yeah. So like I said, we didn't find when we compared those two groups. Now we could probably dive a bit deeper on a person by person level and really look at, okay, those people who really shared the material with their partner, did they benefit in a different way versus even the partnered women who didn't share? That's something we haven't looked into yet.
It's super interesting. And I ask my followers on Instagram to ask you questions about this topic. And I have a few questions for you, very practical kind of. Here's the first one is how to limit intrusive thoughts to stay connected to the present moment. We see really like a lot of women saying, you know, I'm thinking about my to-do list. I can't, you know, I'm thinking about the things I have to do. I can't really be there. Like, how can we limit intrusive thoughts?
So one of the fundamental tenets of mindfulness is viewing thoughts as mental events, something the brain does. And the idea is that when we elevate the importance of thoughts by calling them intrusive or calling them important, they capture our attention in a way that's really unhelpful. So we introduce a mindfulness of thoughts practice, which is teaching the women to observe thoughts just like clouds passing through the sky. You see them from the distance, But then they continue on by. You don't have to jump on the cloud. You don't have to analyze the cloud. You can just observe it and see it pass on by. So we practice that in session together. And then for homework, we ask them to apply this skill to things like intrusive thoughts. So they would be encouraged to just notice, oh, my brain is producing a lot of mental activity right now. It's producing planning thoughts. It's producing catastrophizing thoughts. And while it's doing that, I'm going to observe that my brain is doing this, and I'm going to come back to the here and now. So we really encourage them not to engage with the contents of thoughts and not even call them intrusive thoughts. They just call it a byproduct of brain activity.
I like it. And so it's to be aware, to observe, and then to come back to the present moment. And there's one thing also I learned, and I don't know what you think about it, when I was doing orgasmic meditation, is sometimes like what they call check out. You know, you are during sex and then you are somewhere else. It's sometimes because, you know, the sensation that you are experiencing is uncomfortable and it's kind of like you check out. And then it's important to come back to your body in order to adjust, in order to express, okay, I'm done with sex, or I need more lube, or I need to change the position. That's why it's also important, I think, to be present in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And very similarly in mindfulness, we check out, right? And during sex, people will say they check out. They start thinking about one thing, and then before they knew it, they're somewhere else. And 5 minutes have gone by and they've lost touch with what's happening. And again, this is where mindfulness can be really important, because as you ground yourself in physical sensations, either your internal physical sensations of arousal and excitement, as well as the physical sensations of touch that are happening between, say, you and the person you're with, or, you know, if there is another person involved, it helps ground you so that when the mind does escape or go elsewhere, you can root yourself back through physical sensations. It can be a really powerful way of, when the mind escapes, to bring yourself back very quickly.
Well, to bring yourself back in order to also be more responsive into the sensation, because you are more present. If you are more present, you can feel more even of what is happening. Or if you don't feel something, pain or uncomfort, you can adjust very easily.
That's exactly right. So, you know, I often say to people, don't just let your body have sex. Make sure your mind is having sex as well. In other words, be there, be present.
Wow, I love it. I think it's very important. Can you repeat once again for people to really sink with this and remember this sentence?
Yeah. So don't just let your body have sex. Invite your mind along as well.
I have another question. Could you give us 3 tips to be more present with ourselves? And you gave already some, but just 3 tips.
Yeah. Practice it in your general life. So when you're standing in line at the grocery store to pay for your groceries, use that as a moment to practice mindfulness. Feel your feet on the ground. Observe the different colors and shapes that you see. Pay attention to sensations in your body. So every day, choose an activity that you're already doing where you can practice mindfulness. So that would be one tip. A second tip is, don't be hard on yourself. If this is a new practice for you, your mind will be uneasy. You'll find it boring. You'll find it annoying. You might say to yourself, oh, I can't do this. I'm just not, my brain's not wired that way. Treat those judgments as just mental chatter and keep coming back to the present moment. So we want to be very compassionate with ourselves in doing this. And maybe the third thing is, during sexual activity, treat it as a mindful activity. Be curious. Notice sensations in places in your body that maybe you don't normally pay attention to, like what's happening in the earlobes, what's happening at the bottom of your feet during sexual activity. get excited about all the different areas of the body that are feeling sensations. Don't just focus on, you know, the genitals and the nipples and the kind of typical areas, but the entire body can experience sexual pleasure and sexual sensations. And so use mindfulness as a way to acquaint yourself with that.
Super important. So to practice in general life first, because it's true, sometimes people are just focusing on, okay, I will put more mindfulness, I will put more mindfulness into my sex life. But if you are not already doing it in other aspects of your life, it may be more difficult. So first to practice, second to not be too hard when it's a new practice, because it's going to be uncomfortable, boring, as you said. I mean, for me, it was very boring at the beginning. I was like, I'm so bad at this. I will never be able to do this. You know, and then at some point you keep on going, you know, you come back to why you are doing it and then you keep on going. And then at some point you understand and you are just experiencing it. Mm-hmm. And the third point, what you said as a tip is like treating sex as a mindfulness practice, but more so the entire body to really be aware of what the body is feeling.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You summarized it very well.
Thank you. And for those people who actually are the one being a bit hard on themselves, or they want to do it, but they don't believe in themselves, they don't know how to start, how can they begin to incorporate mindfulness into their daily sex life or into their intimacy?
Yeah, I love the eating meditation. And when we start our groups, I always start with an eating meditation. So we hand out a plate of raisins, or if you're doing this online, we ask people to go get a raisin, and then we guide them through very mindfully observing all the sensations that come up as they're looking at their raisin, as they smell their raisin, as they hold the raisin to the ear, they put the raisin in the mouth and just let it sit there, and they experience all of the salivation. And then very slowly taking one bite, feeling the flavors, and then feeling the jaw as it chews down more. So you can really use eating, which is something we all do every day, as a way to start to cultivate those skills of paying attention non-judgmentally. So you might say to yourself, okay, I'm going to practice mindfulness in the first 5 minutes of my meal. I'm going to eat slowly. I'm going to notice the flavors. I'm going to feel my jaw, and then sort of build on it from there. Once you start to develop and cultivate those skills of present moment, non-judgmental awareness.
Oh. And when you were talking about, you know, like being mindful when we eat, I just, you know, thought I came back from Singapore, but it's all around the world, it might be the same thing, seeing people eating and watching, you know, a movie or being on their phone or on the tablet. Do you see a difference, you know, because you started decades ago? Is it more difficult now in the present moment to be mindful about what we are doing? Do you see a difference in people or not necessarily?
100% I see a difference, because we are accessible to anyone 24 hours a day through our little handheld computers. And we also, I think, as a society, have a lot of discomfort with boredom or eating alone, except maybe the French. I was in Paris last summer and observed many people eating alone at a cafe, you know, sitting down to lunch, eating their lunch, watching people walk by. And I thought, what a beautiful example of mindful eating. Yes. But I think your question in general, Camille, is you are right that in general, we feel like we have to be doing something. And there's this message of multitasking as if it's something that we want to achieve. We want to be ordering groceries on our phone and reading the news and having a conversation and planning something all at the same time. And it's really hard on our brains. Our brains cannot multitask. They can do one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I am seeing a lot more of it. And I also have teenage kids who are, you know, glued to their phone. And I always say, put it down and just observe your surroundings and be okay with boredom. You know, in boredom leads to discovery and curiosity and appreciating things that you wouldn't notice if you weren't kind of glued to your phone. So,
yes, I mean, I think you are right. It's people are afraid of boredness, like to be bored, but also afraid of looking around and observing actually. And it's funny that you took the example of Paris, because it's only in Paris that I'm eating alone in restaurants and I'm observing, because I think the way also we are sitting, you know, like the chair are facing the streets and we can observe people. So it's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's not boring.
I made that same observation, pointed it out to my family as we were sitting there. And I said, isn't it fascinating that all the chairs are facing out? And I think it's really encouraging, you know, eating and looking and taking in your surroundings all at the same time.
Exactly. And yes, and with teenagers, the screen, but it's a whole different topic.
Right.
but it's interesting. And what about mindfulness with a partner? Like, how do we start if I have a partner, which maybe, let's say, a partner who also wants to integrate mindfulness into the intimacy of the relationship? How do the people do that?
Yeah. So a relatively simple way of introducing it is have the two members of the couple practice mindfulness at the same time. So maybe sitting beside each other or sitting back to back, and maybe you play a guide of the body scan. And so you're independently practicing your mindfulness, but in close proximity. That might be a place to start. But then over time, there's actual mindfulness exercises that are designed for the couple. So, you know, looking into each other's eyes and experiencing the sensations that come up, but also noticing if there's some evaluation happening. Sensate focus obviously is a classic couples based mindfulness exercise. So I think there's a variety of different ways that you can incorporate a partner into practicing mindful sex.
Mm-hmm. And it's easy to find on internet, or to ask some couple therapist or sexologist, or even buying books, you know, so people who are interested, they can easily also find those resources. But then it's to put it in practice, and not only once, you know, but several times.
Yeah.
And what about if one partner really wants to include, you know, slow sex, mindfulness, and the other one into like, no, it's not my thing, I'm bored with these kind of things. How you will approach those kind of
couples therapy? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but it's true.
but it might point to a deeper disconnect between the couple, not just on mindfulness, but on, you know, is there lack of synchrony on other topics as well. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but just recognizing that, you know, where there is that kind of discordance between one partner and another partner. So that would be a place where I would want to explore it in a bit more detail. But we also need to keep in mind, you can't force anyone to practice mindfulness, right? It kind of defies the tenet of compassion if you're forcing someone to do it. That's not a very compassionate thing to do. So hopefully the partner who is more skeptical will observe the other person's embodying of this, experiencing better quality of life, experiencing deeper sexual feelings, and then want to get in on it over time. That's kind of, you know, what we would hope, that there's more of an intrinsic, oh, I want what you have, and therefore I'm going to start to do what you're doing.
Like hoping for modeling, for inspiration, influencer of this practice. I have a question. I don't know what to answer to this when people say, you know, I have a lot of fantasies when I'm having sex with my partner. I have fantasies. So I mean, into my mind, and I'm not present in the moment.
Yeah.
What do you think about this?
Excellent question. It's come up quite a few times in our groups, because fantasy is not mindfulness. Fantasy, by definition, is going outside of the mind into a different place. So either a made-up scenario or deep into a memory. And so we actually have an exercise in our group that we've given to people where we say, you know, practice this at home, take 10 minutes and have a fantasy or engage with a vibrator or watch erotica. And during those 10 minutes, you know, try and really boost and elicit your sexual arousal and sexual response. And then after 10 minutes, stop and come back to a mindfulness practice. So the idea is by first eliciting a strong sexual arousal response, does that then allow you to use mindfulness skills to be much more present in the here and now? So we actually evaluated this and published a study that where we asked people to do this, and our comparison group was imagery, so not fantasy, but just imagery paired with the kind of sexual fantasy. And so, but what we found was pairing fantasy and mindfulness had much stronger effects on sexual arousal, both self-reported sexual arousal as well as physiological sexual arousal, which we measured in a laboratory setting.
Wow, super interesting. So you will recommend that people first, if they have fantasies, that fantasy really helps them, like increase their excitement, turn them on, like to do it, but for a certain period of time, and then being into the present moment, because when you have fantasies, yeah, you are not in the present moment.
Yeah, that's how we have recommended it. Now, there may be other times where people just want to stay in their fantasy.
Yeah,
right. Maybe. And good for them. They want to stay there. They want to just be in the fantasy the entire time. And that's fine too. But again, to be clear, that's not mindfulness.
Okay. Very interesting. Because for me, I was saying that, yeah, it's mindfulness. But I was like, no, I'm not sure, because, okay, so now, yeah, I have my answer from the queen. So I'm glad. Is mindfulness for everyone?
Yes. 100% for everyone. So let me say something about gender. Many of our studies have focused on women, cisgender women primarily, although increasingly we're working hard to recruit gender diverse people as well. We do also have studies in men. We've published a few studies in men. In my clinical practice, I use mindfulness with all people, all genders, all ages, whether they have concurrent depression, whether they have a trauma history or not. Now, obviously, we want to make some adaptations, mm-hmm, depending on the individual person's psychological health. And we want to make sure that, you know, say it's a person who has an extensive trauma history, we might start a lot more slowly. And especially if they're prone to dissociation, we want to start, mm-hmm, very, very slowly, et cetera. But my experience is that mindfulness really is for everyone.
It's for everyone. And you were talking about trauma, like in the Netflix series called Pleasure, where you mentioned it, that we can train our brains to experience pleasure even after traumatic brain injuries or trauma or physical condition. How does it work, you know?
Yeah, it's so interesting. There's research in the spinal cord injury literature and also in the traumatic brain injury literature that shows that people can develop psychogenic orgasms, which basically means they, you know, their body doesn't even have to be touched. They can develop centers in the brain and kind of sprouting of new neural material that responds to imagery and sexual fantasies and produce even orgasms through that route. So I think that it is such a powerful observation that shows just how important our brain and our mind is for sexual pleasure.
Yeah, as you were saying, like, you know, like the mind is super important, and we can see it as well when we have like when you dream and you have orgasm during your dream, it's like the power of the brain also, the power, yeah, of the mind.
Yeah.
And so it's something that we can train in order, like, for example, how do you train your brain to pleasure? Is it by practice? Is it by being able to experience pleasure and to associate what you're feeling with pleasure, what you are seeing with pleasure?
Yeah, it's all of those things. it might be challenging for listeners who are struggling with, yeah, but don't you need touch? Don't you need, isn't touch essential in that? And the truth is no, touch is not essential. And we have pretty convincing scientific data that show us again that psychogenic orgasms, or in other words, having an orgasm through purely psychological stimulation, can be sufficient. So the brain is malleable, it's plastic, it continues to grow and respond to cues in our environment up until we die. It's not the case that you only have a short window of time that the brain is capable of growing and changing. This continues throughout life. And that's why it's also really important for us to really continue to exercise our brain throughout our lives.
A very important reminder, like the brain is a sexual organ and it needs to be practiced as well.
Yeah, just like a muscle, right? All of the exercise guidelines tell us that we need to use our muscles throughout our entire life for health and longevity and preventing things like fractures and falls, et cetera. And I would love to see more messages about the brain, the importance of us doing the same to our brain.
Thank you. We are at the end of this podcast. I wonder if there's another questions or some things that you would like to mention, some things that I didn't ask you and you would like to ask you.
No, I think your questions were excellent. And to anyone who is intrigued on incorporating mindfulness into their life, into their sex life, it's important to recognize that mindfulness is simple, but not easy. It's simple in that all we're doing is paying attention non-judgmentally. It's not easy because we're paying attention non-judgmentally. So the repeated practice, the being kind to yourself, is something that indeed does take consistency and practice. And I think sometimes remembering that, or realizing that, there actually is very good scientific evidence for these tools that can sometimes help people stay in there a little bit longer. That's my kind of invitation to the listeners.
Yes, simple but not easy. And for those who are sometimes skeptical and need really rational, evidence, then they can look at your articles, at all the research, to be guided, to have some coach, to have some supervisors that can help them through this process. Because at the end, after practices, it's simple because it's free. We can do it anywhere. It's a key also and a tool to understand better about ourselves, what we feel, how we feel, the way we want to be touched, the way we want to move into our environment. So it's simple but not easy. Thank you very much, Dr. Laurie. Where the people can find you, find your work, get in touch with you?
Yeah, thank you. I loved your questions and a great conversation. You can find me on social media at Dr. Laurie Brado. You can also follow our research website, our research team that posts a lot about different studies that we're doing and study findings. And that's at UBCSHR, so UBC Sexual Health Research. And then my website, lauriebrado.com, I have links to many of the meditations that I've guided, so they're recorded and on the website, and anyone can download them and listen to them.
Wow, that's excellent resources that I will put on the episode, because thank you for sharing all of this, sharing your works. Thank you so much, Dr. Laurie, for this very, very passionate conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me.